Who's got a question? For anyone, it doesn't matter who. Would you like to start?
I have a question for Christian, and it's to do with the role of metaphor. And my view is that metaphor is such an important and large part of how we understand the world and how we get meaning from it. But the fact that some statements that that are both metaphor and categorical mistakes, I don't think that matters at all, because what's important is how we decide whether that metaphor is true or not. And the fact that it's a categorical mistake is fairly irrelevant. You just need to go to the context of what's being said and possibly the culture in which that sentence is spoken. So
I agree that metaphor is extremely important. I think that most of the language, or a lot of the language, has a metaphorical origin. If you analyze the origin of the different words, you find a lot of metaphorical. I think those was an example. Mistake, you analyze this kind of metaphor. And and probably, when you say it doesn't matter, probably what you mean that there's a continuum, let's say a sentence which I grasp immediately as meaningful and contentful, maybe is a very great metaphor, and then we need additional effort, cognitive mental effort, to make sense out of metaphors that go more and more out of the comfort zone of meaning modulations, let's call it like this. So probably you're right, say, okay, this is a kind of continuum. And but the point is that I think there's a difference between expressions that we can make sense out of it and expressions we can't. So there are clear cases of both, and I don't know where the exact boundary is. It's kind of, you know, has to do with weightness, or also it's the whole thing is in the weights thing. And but I think that like the complex example I showed is clearly nonsense. There's no content. I mean, we cannot possibly exceed a certain complexity. I think there's no way that we can, probably another kind of being which would be more intelligent can, you know, could make sense out of this, maybe. But I think that there are clear cases where that work, and then what we don't recognize as metaphor, maybe it's just a very great metaphor. So, yeah.
Does anyone want to comment on that? Go on, Bob, then
Mike. I'll say something else, well, on this idea, but almost all the examples of category mistakes we saw were ones invented by people giving examples of category mistakes. But the sort of thing Ryle was after, like, for instance, the mind and the body are separate, or the mind is identical with the brain, he would say, I think quite rightly, that those are category mistakes. But what someone who says them genuinely means is something like the body and the mind are entities of the same logical type, and what's more, they're identical. That's the sort of thing Russell would say about it, isn't it? And that, you could say, is just false. So I wonder if the examples you gave, Christian, aren't all artificial. Real category mistakes are actually false, because they do actually mean something in the mind of, they can be analysed as meaning something which the speaker didn't quite realise he meant, but in, nonetheless did mean, or must have meant, in order for it to be meaningful.
I mentioned that the simple examples, probably we don't recognize them as having mistakes, so it's relevant, you know. But you mentioned, for example, the category mistakes that Ryle speaks of. I think it's not obviously a category mistake in the sentence. It is, you know, to grasp it as a category mistake, you need to have the whole concept around mind, the whole concept around body, and a lot of description. So it's a kind of discourse about the problem. And then the category mistake appears on the level of the discourse, I think, not on the level of a sentence, a specific sentence. So in this sense, okay, you know, it's very difficult to discuss very complex cognitive mistakes. It's easier to discuss simple ones. So we have, I think it's a methodological very simple ones to make the point clear. But I don't think there's a difference in kind between the cognitive mistakes of Ryan and the sentence where you put two concepts together which just don't fit to see the meaning. So to understand, for example, the point of Ryan, to understand it, you need to think much more, right? You need to get into what he means, into the concept, and then, okay, you see it's a current mistake. And then in the simple sense, you see it immediately because there are only two simple concepts.
Mike, so that we don't have only the panel speaking and not, if you could try and keep your, because I've now got two more members of the panel who want to come in, and the panel should come first, should they? We can make this a democratic decision.
The audience
ought to get a look in our community degree. That's why I'm saying we need to keep this. So
the audience has spoken, over to the audience.
Well, actually, most people put their hands up. So, okay, let's put the hands up now. Would you like to hear mostly from the panel, or would you like to hear mostly from people in the audience? Hands up if it's the panel. Pete, Frank, you're next.
Again, Christian, I think this question of the meaningfulness of the sentence depends so much on the context of the sentence. And I'd just like to draw attention to that in two ways. You've given us a very narrow definition of meaning to the extent that the sentence has to express a truth valuable proposition. Well, if that is the case, then it rules out an awful lot of things that I would have called meaning, for example, insofar as a lot of sentences don't convey meaning that way. For example, in poetry, they evince emotions and so on, which I would include within meaning. And again, it's the context of the sense of soul. From Lewis Carroll, Swivey Tobes, all that is terribly meaningful. And just if you take the number twos being green, well, she's talking about buses. We know that all the even numbers are green, all the odd numbers are red, so all the odd number twos are green. So the context, it seems to me, is at least as important as this analysis of the particulars of the sentence, both metaphorical or otherwise.
Sorry, can I just say that apropos that, a signer's beat might actually see the number two as queen.
Yes. So, no, I'm talking to...
That's a very interesting point.
I have got people on the list. Don't get worried.
I agree. So
for her, it's a reality.
I mentioned again my wife. My wife seriously hopes that numbers out. My suspicion is that he just associates numbers with cards, so I'm not sure if it's really. I think it's very complicated. I have not an answer. And what we're saying is, you know, we say that, you know, these are extraordinary phenomena. But I have no answer to that. But you're right. It's something to think about. And. What am I saying? Maybe other kind of beings, or species, or extreme cases of human beings, which are outside, which are outliers, so to speak, they can make sense of things we can't make sense. So I'm not saying, you know, just for a human being, a normal human being, it be nonsense, and so we need to relativize it a lot.
And John's reason for saying that it is green. It's because he totally believes everything that Julie says is true over his own judgment.
Yes, speaking as a normal human being, I have to say that for me, Tuesday is green and crescent shaped. But I want to move on. It's this term category mistake, which I think is a mistake, because I think it's being smeared too far across too many categories, in fact. If you say category clash, that would be a more neutral term. And would apply to all the examples you've given. A category mistake is something that produces a puzzle or a problem like the mind-body thing or where is the university, that kind of thing. But the metaphor, Juliet as the sun, is a category clash, but it's a very creative one. I mean, Shakespeare builds up to it, you know, but lower, soft, a light beyond the window breaks. It is the east. And Juliet is the sun. It's a beautiful crescendo. It's actually carefully worked up to. And it's the logical, in a way, logical culmination, climax of the whole sequence of statements. So that's not a mistake. But that's, it's a stroke of a master craftsman. It's a clash. But it's a deliberate about.
Yes, it's not a mistake, but it's literally a mistake. So I want to say, if you take the most conventional meaning, it is a mistake. The flesh doesn't make sense. But there's enough elasticity in modulating meanings so that suddenly it makes click. And this is exactly this moment where you recognize your creativity. So I still believe that under certain content is a mistake, but this does not mean, as I said before, metaphors at the end, we have two intuitions, it makes sense, it doesn't make sense. So they make sense under this new modulation, which is creative, because it goes out of conventional, but it doesn't make sense on as conventionally understood.
I think it's a mistake, but it's
you can call it flesh.
Right, gentlemen. I'd like to challenge the notion that causation is an empirical fact and suggest it's merely a belief that we try and make sense of the world. You mentioned about quantum behaviour. Well, there was a big dispute between Einstein and Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist, over the nature of reality and so on. And the aspect experiment, the latest experiment with them, was a single electron that would go through in a double slit experiment, and both slits activate at the same time and exhibit behavior of wave behavior and a mass particle. And this is not explainable in terms of causation. And so I would challenge the whole idea that we must accept this as being true in all circumstances.
No, with that comment, or you expect?
I'm challenging that idea.
But is there a question?
Determinism and causation were empirical facts which we have to accept. And I'm saying I don't think that is actually the case.
I think the law of cause and effect is something like, say, gravity or electric charge that physics can measure it, but they can't actually explain what it is. It's certainly true that quantum behavior is weird. I think brought about by the fact that the motion of particles is governed by probability functions, but the actual probability functions themselves follow causal laws. So I think it does have, at the quantum level, matter does have this dual nature, obviously. It can be accounted as a wave, which is the only way you can explain the dual slit experiment.
I think it's worth pointing out that this is a huge philosophical debate between physicists about reality, which is still going on. I think it's misleading to suggest this is an established fact believed by all scientists. And I think that it's true, isn't it, that determinism, whether we live in a deterministic world, is a matter of philosophical debate.
Well, I was going to say, even if the physicists discussing how to interpret that quantum experiment, there's also the question of whether if the physical world is determined, that means that we don't have free will.
Okay, can I just make a comment about what I was proposing? That was an assertion. It wasn't a claim that I was aiming to justify. It was an assertion. So even if you're right, and let's say for the moment that you are right, in a deterministic universe, it would be right.
if the universe is deterministic, then your view holds.
Yes.
That's what you're saying. Yeah, right.
Well,
probably not.
Question of the audience, really.
Go on.
Everyone in the audience knows more about science than I do, I hope. And on the panel. Is it true that either an event is caused, determined, or that it happens at random? Is that just a logical necessity?
No.
If not, that's my question.
Because the answer to that could be it's statistical. I think a statistical event would be somewhere in between the two.
This is a very big discussion that we've just opened. It's maybe a bit too big to answer. Lots of people are telling me they've got tiny little answers. Mike, have you got a tiny little answer?
I usually keep my promises.
That's true, that's why I'm asking you.
It is law-like on the level of types, but it is completely not law-like on the level of tokens. Yes. The laws of class. You can predict the radioactive decay for a lot of atoms. You cannot, in principle, predict it as completely uncaused for any given atom.
Only if I can.
My short answer would be that I just have never understood why people mix up cause and prediction. The fact that something cannot be predicted says absolutely nothing about whether it's caused or not. Absolutely nothing. Most of the things that have taken place in the world up until now, and probably still the case now, we cannot predict because we don't understand enough. But it doesn't mean it's not caused. I think the default position should be it was caused.
But Bob's question was, are things either determined or random?
Well, I don't know. I don't think random exists.
No,
let me put my bit in. The answer is we don't know, because if people act freely, then they're not determined, and they're not acting at random, they're acting for reasons. And so if reason-governed behaviour is neither determined nor random, the answer to your question is no. But of course, we don't actually know whether that's the case. We are still talking about that. So the answer to your question is we don't know.
Reasons are caused.
No.
They're not random.
Well, I don't think anything. You tell me what random means. I can't.
Should we move on? It's your question next.
Yes, Christian. Like most people here, I'm all for metaphors, hooray, and the language and the rest of the world, but I think it is important. And therefore, it's important to recognise a category mistake when there is one. And I think several people here must have come to the talk by Ray Challis on My Brain, and he pointed out a very important category mistake when he mentioned the binding problem. Now, this is important to science, because the binding problem could only refer to the mind and not to the brain, because there was no evidence physically for any binding process going on. So that is what I consider a serious category mistake. And, worth defining.
Yeah, I don't know what the binding
It's putting a whole lot of sensory impressions together.
Okay.
In the moment or from the memory. Whereas there is nowhere in the brain where the meeting of these pathways is found, and there's no actual little mechanism that clicks them all into place.
That is precisely a category mistake.
Absolutely.
It's a mistake to think there would be. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Or just using the words binding problem is misleading.
Are you saying there isn't a binding problem?
There is a binding problem. There exactly is a binding problem, but it's a binding problem that refers to our capacities of mind and has no replication in our physical brains.
Okay, I didn't think there was a binding problem.
Are you saying Challis made a category mistake?
I'm saying that he was pointing out that a category mistake is made by people like Jeanette and Susan Greenfield or Greenwood or, you know, people who think that the mind is the brain.
That seems to contradict the observation in Dimmel's writing, namely that neural networks can identify spontaneously certain features.
Yes.
That seems to be a classic example of the binding actually happening in hardware. But I think that Professor Challis is wrong on that one.
Interesting. It's not a category mistake in fact, the case. But he convinced me that there wasn't. He's a gerontologist, but you know, he maintained that there was no evidence physically in the brain for the binding problem.
Yes, another.
It's only a binding problem if you assume non-binding in the first place. It's the wrong assumption to say that. You know, a brain has developed within a unified body which is after a unified aim of staying alive and trying to do all the things that it needs to do to do that. You would expect.
Exactly. You would expect.
Right.
The
I'm sorry.
Can we? My brain.
We're. If every question sparks a discussion that everyone wants to join in, we're not going to get the questions from the floor that we wanted. So I'm going to, from now on, start imposing a little bit of order. I'm sorry if you don't want me to do that. No, that really gets up my nose. Peter.
Question for Mike. I'll tell you what I take your thesis to have been. If I've got your thesis wrong, then I'll drop my question. I take it your thesis is that we run through the various mind-body relationship theories, match onto anomalous monism as a sort of popular plausible one, which you seem to like, and then say that the way computers work is analogous to, is an intuition pump that will fit that picture, and therefore they qualify in the same way the anomalous monist thoughts qualify.
Yeah, I didn't quite go that far, and several people challenged me on this one. I'm not proposing a direct analogy between hardware, software, and brain mind.
Yeah.
All I'm doing is to relocate the structure of the argument from one context to another in order to see whether the structure in itself can work by itself. And having shown that it can work by itself, I'm saying that if you want to deny it for the brain-mind context, you need some additional arguments specific to that context.
Okay, I'll ask my question. The structure of the argument, that my reaction to anomalous monism is, I'm afraid I'm one of these dreadful reductive physicalists, like people that everyone in the room seems to hate, never mind, press on. But my reaction to anomalous monism is that it starts off by saying, right, well, we've got the mind here, and then we've got the brain here, and we're going to try and map the relationship between them. And we say, well, we seem to have causation here, I'm not sure we've got causation there. And so we've now got a hell of a problem, and we're going to invent some sort of supervenience theory to explain this strange relationship between the two. But the whole thing is premised on that you had two things to start with that we're having to relate. Well, that's, I don't know whether you're shaking your head about Davidson, but Doc Donaldson, that's my reading of it. But all those sort of theories, they just seem to have dualism built into the first sentence of the discussion. So they sort of drive me slightly crazy. But my challenge to you is that when you gave, for example, the account of the blue screen crash, you said this is a clear case, I think, of software causing hardware to go pear-shaped. But running a software, my reading is basically you've just got sort of binary switches going on and off all over the place and things. If you blew that up like Leibniz's mill to a human size, all you'd see is that these things go flip flop, flip flop, flop, and then suddenly they all get jammed for some reason, yeah. And then the screen goes blue. Well, that seems to me to be an entirely hardware event. Yeah. And so I put it to you that you're introducing a dualism between hardware and software in order to make it map onto Davis, which is legitimate.
Yes. Really charming.
Yes. You started from your own premises, and hence you got misled into somewhat misunderstanding what I'm trying to say. I do not believe that Davidson actually starts with saying, here's the physical world and here's the mind, let's smack it all together. No, he starts with, it's all one thing. Yeah. How do we explain the fact that we've got two separate accounts for it? One is the physical third-person view account, and one is the first-person view account of how it feels to us, how it seems to us. And his answer is, on the lines of translation, a la Quine, to say it is one reality, but described in two different and incompatible manners. There is no distinction. Yes, it is in computers, it is all in no bits. But I challenge you to give me the cause of the screen of death by looking at the flipping of bits. Mm. That is the difficulty. Whereas if you look at the software level, the cause is becoming immediately obvious. The system crashed.
The software system crashed. I agree with your reading,
David. The point here is that the property of the software of having a bug in it which would cause a crash is completely independent of it running on a computer. You can look at the static list of software printout and say, oh, here's a bug. It is there. It is in the software itself. And it's that bug which is in the software itself that causes the crash.
Are you a dualist about software then?
No, I'm not. Those are two separate descriptions of the same identical thing.
Yeah, Christian wants to say
something. You committed a category mistake. because okay, you can refer in two ways to the same thing. So we have a concept of hardware and a concept of software, and what we are really searching is a new concept which includes everything. Yeah? We look at the morning star, we look at the evening star, and we want to see if maybe this is Venus. Okay, so. So in this sense, I wouldn't say that if we start with two things, we start with dualism. I mean, there's another two things, maybe two concepts or two ways to refer to something.
The picture that we're conceptualizing to one thing in two different ways, I buy that completely.
That's
that
is what Davidson says.
Right. Well, they're on the same side.
Jean.
Fucking me already, this is your time. I was just going to bring up about metaphor. The other speaker on that weekend with TELUS was Ian McGilchrist, and in his book he says that the left brain can't cope with metaphor. And I thought that Christian's way of approaching metaphor was the left brain trying to cope with it. Because what the right brain does is say, wow, like Peter said, this is this, wow, because you see, you're directed to a new commonality between those two things. The left brain approach is to say, this isn't right, let's try this. Ah, this. And I just wanted to point that out.
As I understand it, there are two brain halves, one is analytic, the other is kind of holistic. But this would fit in the picture. You could say that the meaning is analytic, so you have the grammar, you have individual words and their meanings. And what you try to do is on the things of right hand side to make sense out of all in a holistic way,
can start from the right hand so that you're not starting over here and then making sense of it. You start from the right, and if you say Julie, this is something you call it to play, you don't need all this other stuff. That's the point.
I think it's a very important point. As I understand it, autists, they see only the details, the individual elements. So maybe,
or people with autism.
They cannot integrate the whole thing.
Yeah.
into a unit. So, and I guess that office cannot understand metaphors. I think it requires this integration. But I know too little about brain physiology to be confident to think to answer this question.
Speak up, Fiona, please. Can't hear you.
It's not so much a question so much as I was going to challenge the way that you were talking about metaphors, in that I think that McGilchrist would be suggesting that the right hemisphere takes a global view of the world, and it will see many similarities between certain things. Then it hands over this aspect to the left hemisphere, which is very analytical. And the left hemisphere will then be discerning just where the similarities are and joining those into a new concept, so that you get a blanket of snow where there's a covering in each case, and the covering is smoothing out the outlines, and it also nurtures, according to some people, the plants in the ground, because it protects them from the worst cold in the air. The similarities are what you're looking for between what a blanket does or is and what a layer of snow does or is, so that you can call it a blanket. Does that make sense? You look for similarities between the two.
There are a lot of theories on metaphor. One is the similarity theory, where say, okay, metaphor is really it's just a comparison. So to say that Juliet is the sun means that Juliet is like the sun. So there are some similarities. I think we cannot enter into the discussion of those different theories. I think it is wrong, because.
Okay, but even if you leave that, Julie is the sun isn't really the totality of the metaphor. It's the fact that Julie is something to do with light. It's this, I'm forgetting names.
Peter.
Was there before. And then also the warmth of the sun and the brightness and the enlightenment that it brings you. There's a lot more going on in the metaphor than just the sun.
We'll definitely move on. Chris?
There was quite a lot of discussion early on about the law of cause and effect. And my recollection of physics is that that's rarely talked about. We talk about the law of causality, and both quantum physics and classical physics and everything, really. All that means is that the future is only determined by the past. It's not determined by the distant future. So in fact, what happens next depends on what's happening now. And that's all it means. It doesn't depend on the distant past. So there is causality. Now, so the question is this, to the whole panel. Do you think, for example, when we're thinking, one of the key characteristics of thought is that it enables us to evade the physical law of causality? In that, for example, I sat at the back so that I could be first in the queue for the bar. I planned that some 4 hours ago. Now, this is an example of evading the law of cause and effect. So do you think thought enables us to do that?
I think the reason that we developed thought was that thought predicts the future. It allows us to predict the future.
Can I just respond to
that? I've just said no to someone else who wanted to respond to. I can put you on the list, and so if you remember what was said, but Mike, go on.
Yeah, my answer is most certainly not. I support anthropomorphism, as we already discussed. And all you are doing, you are providing a reasons interpretation of the everything that is going on, which can be also described in physical terms. The two do not exclude each other. And you are, by the way, wrong. There are transactional interpretations of quantum mechanics which actually demand that the future influences the past.
Yes. That's what I was going to say.
Actually, the scientists are all nodding at that.
And Anne said earlier that reasons are causes, and a lot of people believe that reasons are causes, and if they are, then acting for reasons doesn't take us out of the causal
mechanism. All reasons are caused.
Oh, okay.
A reason is a cause, like a cause by person's history.
But then in that case, let me not attribute it to Anne, but let me say that many people think reasons are causes, and if they are, then acting for reasons doesn't take us out of the causal nexus. But if reasons are not causes...
Reasons are causes in the case of reason.
Okay, gentlemen, sorry, I don't know your name.
Tim. What game I like to play is the way it joins all the talks together. And I'm not sure if this is the only one, or the key one either, but what's interesting to me is that every talk had two different concepts involved. So it was either the physical state to the mental state. It was hardware to software. It was the strange attractor within a chaotic system that somehow through an emergent process may create sentience or experience. We have we had language and concepts, we had statements and propositions. And I just wonder whether there's something in that we in all these topics we're actually thinking about the same sort of thing. It's all this translation between body and mind. And that we instinctively are looking for a single way of translating one to the other, whether it's a psychophysical law, or whether in Christian's case it's the conventional meaning of a sentence, the literal meaning of it. I just wondered whether, taking something from Mike's talk, is that there is actually a multiple realizability going on in every one of these, some kind of inherent multiple realizability. It means you can't draw those one-to-one relationships, and that some whatever this thing called mind is, every single instance of a mind is doing its own translation. So there isn't a single set of psychophysical laws. There's some information internally within this mind that we bring to the topic, that we bring to that translation. Like Mike was saying, that you have systems that have some key that is then destroyed. I don't know, I'm just looking for an insight that maybe there's something in that, and maybe that's the problem we have when we try to relate these two concepts, this inherent multiple realizability.
This is a topic I have frequently discussed with Peter Townsend, and we very much agree on this one. The real problem, and a lot of problems in this whole area, stems from the fact that we do inherently have two different views on nature. One is the first person point of view, the way the universe and myself appear and feel to me. And the other is the third person point of view, which attempts to abstract from this first person point of view to give a description which is common to all of us. And the two simply do not match. And therefore, a lot of philosophy of mind is truly trying to reconcile two. And to my mind, anomalous monism is a very successful way of doing exactly that. That in fact, we are talking about one thing, we are just talking about it in different ways.
What I was just reminded of as we were speaking was Fred Hoyle, when his steady state theory was eventually rejected. And some commentator said, Fred Hoyle has never forgiven the scientific community or the universe for the steady state theory. And I think when relating that to your question, it's no good saying, let's have a multi-thing, let all wonderful flowers blossom and all that stuff. If the world goes on saying, we want one, we want unity, and it's going to go on saying it, because there is something, I think, special about getting a single understanding. And, you know, Fred Hoyle has to put up with it.
But do we have to have single description of that one something? The point is, I can't see why. It would be very interesting if we ever encounter alien intelligence to know whether or not, for example, their conception of mathematics would be the same. If we ever, one thing I would really like to say here, this one massive misconception about artificial intelligence
that artificial intelligence is to do is replicating human mind. It is not. Only very few nuts in the area think that. The whole point is to create behave systems which we would recognize as behaving sentiently without at the same time expecting them to be like us. Because always theorizing about minds, we are theorizing from one data point. The only intelligence we know is our own. Insofar as we can see any in animals, it is also our own because we belong to the same family. We developed from them. Their intelligence is not going to be qualitatively different from ours. We need a second data point. If we aren't going to meet it from aliens, we need to make one.
There's one more question, which comes from Robert. Robert?
No.
Sorry?
Close.
What is it?
Stephen.
That's very
close. We can all go to the bar, actually, because the question I was about to ask, Mike has just thoroughly answered. But I can't be bothered thinking of another question.
That's very easy in that case. But I think we ought to thank our speakers because they've been so...